Current State on 90.5 WKAR for Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. The federal farm bill that's been stalled for months in Congress is a step closer to reality. On Tuesday, the bill passed the Senate Agriculture Committee, and of course, our Senator Debbie Stabenow has an awful lot to do with the Farm Bill and the Senate Agriculture Committee. She's the chair. The legislation eliminates direct crop subsidies to farmers and consolidates many existing programs. Debbie Stabenow chairs that committee once again. She says this version, quote, has Michigan on every page.
So the special crop title is critical, and we've expanded it. We've tripled the amount of dollars for farmers markets, for what we call local food hubs, like Traverse City as an example, or certainly other places around the state that are developing ways to bring in and market local foods. We've expanded some really successful efforts around nutrition, people being able to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables. So I think it's easy to say Michigan's on every page.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow there here on Current State. Coming up on the program, Michigan author, kayaker and canoer, Doc Fletcher. He's written 5 books. He's working on his 6th. He's on the way to talk about Michigan's greatest rivers. And we're going to talk about buildings that changed America. One of the 10 buildings that changed America is in Michigan. Find out what that is later on here on Current State. First, love it or hate it, the Affordable Care Act has been talked about and talked about some more, but has yet to materialize in concrete changes that most Americans can actually notice. That is about to change very soon. And here in Michigan, one of the first major signs of the new world order in American healthcare is Consumers Mutual. The new East Lansing-based health insurance company received a $72 million federal loan as part of the Affordable Care Act to become what's called a consumer-operated and oriented plan, or conveniently shortened to co-op. It operates much like a credit union where members will have an ownership stake in the company. And here to tell us more about how Consumers Mutual works is its CEO, Dennis Litos. Welcome, Dennis.
Good morning.
You've compared Consumers Mutual to a credit union in that it will be a 51% member-owned operation and you'll be a non-profit. Tell us a little bit more about how Consumers Mutual will work.
Well, Mark, you know, the difference in a co-op model of governance in the insurance industry is that in addition to being a consumer-governed organization, which is important because we'll sell commercial insurance to individuals and small groups throughout the state, so we're talking about small business and individuals, they will have a say-so in how we govern the organization. And one of the key things that co-ops do with excess profits is they reinvest in keeping premiums lower for their members. In addition to that, they work on expanding benefits, and they have the ability to partner well with their providers throughout the state. The key difference here is that our excess reserves aren't going toward buying additional insurance companies or doing other things other than helping to keep premium flat and insurance affordable for our members.
How many other companies like yours do you know you'll be competing with? New companies like yours. Are there many or are there just a few?
There are several co-op insurances throughout the country, and we're one of 24 that was approved for loan funding under the Affordable Care Act.
Is there another one that our listeners might be familiar with?
There would be Health Partners in Minneapolis is a large one, Wisconsin, Farmers Co-op out in Seattle, Group Sound, and a number like that throughout the country. Here in Michigan, we're the only nonprofit co-op insurance company under that model. And there are some other insurers who currently provide Medicaid coverage in the state that are filing for a commercial license in the state and will also be new competitors in the state of Michigan.
You'll be competing with Sparrow's PHP and McLaren Health Plan locally. How will you attract customers with those competitors on the landscape already?
Well, our target market is the uninsured today, and those are those folks that range between 138% and 400% of poverty. That's our primary market as we get started, and of course, all individuals will be our market in the long-term future. There's about 542,000 of them that are currently uninsured throughout the state. We're building a good, effective network throughout the state with providers, so we will certainly compete with the other insurance companies. But we do have a little bit of a niche, and that is that our founding governance was consisting of a group of county health plans in the state that were already in existence, providing some health care coverage for the uninsured. And in my history, when I was CEO at Ingham Regional Medical Center, named that way in those days, we had the opportunity to start the first county health plan for the uninsured in the state.
Ingham Health Plan,
that's
right?
Correct, Ingham Health Plan. And currently, the CEO of that health plan is on our board, and we have another CEO from two county health plans up north, Bruce Miller. We have public health represented on our board, a consumer advocacy group here in the state of Michigan. The Michigan League for Public Policy is represented on our board. We have small business represented on our board. We have hospital CEO on our board.
Those county health plans will be folded into Consumers Mutual? They will essentially become Consumers Mutual?
No, they won't be folded in, but they have partnered with us to come this far. And in 2014, their funding mechanism is going to disappear. So they will, as of October 1st in 2014, not have the funding they had available to them before. So they were looking for an organization that could pick up some part of that membership that might qualify for subsidy on the health exchange and partner and have an organization that would continue with the same, let's say, mission to ensure that we get folks covered in the state and that we have insurance that's affordable for them.
And under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, you say there are over a half million people in Michigan without health insurance right now. Under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, all of those people will be obligated to purchase some kind of health plan, which opens up this opportunity for you.
Yeah, it opens up an opportunity for those individuals to be subsidized by the federal government and be able to afford health insurance. And the remainder of the uninsured, of course, have the opportunity, hopefully, for Medicaid to cover them in the expansion program here in the state of Michigan.
You're in the process right now of negotiating contracts with hospitals and healthcare providers, I understand. I imagine the network that emerges from that will be provide some kind of leverage for you in terms of the customers that you end up signing up to plans. They want the biggest network they can get, right?
Absolutely. So everyone's looking for access, and we want to make sure that all of our customers have good access to health care and high quality health care throughout the state. One of the I think significant opportunities for the health systems throughout the state and other providers is that this group of patients will now have commercial insurance coverage, which they haven't had historically. So those providers have had to absorb that as uncompensated care. So as the reimbursement system changes and the whole intent behind getting people covered is to do as much as we can to eliminate uncompensated care and to end up with fair and equitable insurance coverage for that population.
Tell us a little bit about these discussions in which you are negotiating these contracts with the hospitals and the healthcare providers. What's at the heart of that process?
Well, the heart of that process is having that discussion that their funding, that which has traditionally come through a mechanism called disproportionate share funding for assisting hospitals and making up some of the losses that they have from uncompensated care for treating those patients historically, gets replaced by individuals that are now covered under a commercial insurance plan.
You'll be relying on, we're talking with Dennis Litos of the newly formed Consumers Mutual healthcare plan. You'll be relying on healthcare exchanges for a good amount of your business. You told the Lansing State Journal around 60%.
Yes.
Initially. Recently, there's been growing concern coming from the Congress, from U.S. Senate Democrats, over the implementation of these exchanges just in the last month or so. Both Senator Max Baucus of Montana, who's an author of the Affordable Care Act, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid say they fear a train wreck. Henry Chow, the government's chief technical officer in charge of putting in place these insurance exchanges, was quoted in the Congressional Quarterly as saying, "I'm pretty nervous. Let's just make sure it's not a third world experience." My question is, how would difficulties implementing these exchanges, whether it was a train wreck or something less, how would that impact your company?
Well, you know, I don't think any different than most organizations that go through computer conversions, having run large health systems. Anytime you go through a major system change and you're bringing up a new system like the Exchange or any kind of information system for your large organization, you're going to have some challenges. And I think that we need to work together to resolve whatever issues evolve. One of the key things that I think we're all challenged by is the short timelines to get things implemented.
There's a funding challenge, though, too, isn't there? I mean, hasn't funding that was anticipated to get the health exchanges up to speed, that's in some jeopardy now?
Well, one of the challenges has been whether or not the legislature in given states has been willing to accept funding from the federal government to help educate the community. And for example, in this state, we gave up several million dollars of funding because our legislature couldn't come together and agree to receive that funding. So I think the biggest challenge is not so much getting information systems up and running appropriately, it's getting people educated. So part of our strategy and part of every health system and I think every health insurer strategy is do as much as we can to educate the community on our own now.
On the federal level and on the state level, how chaotic could this get, though, Dennis? I mean, does this worry you? Is a train wreck possible?
Having worked in the healthcare industry for 35 years, we've been through many, many major changes. When Medicare converted to diagnosis-related groups reimbursement back in the 80s, to just thinking about requirements for having effective essential health records in our organizations and meeting those guidelines and all the changes that we have gone through and all the regulations that we have lived under in the healthcare industry. I think this is simply one more. Will it be more challenging because it's new and different? Sure, absolutely. But, I think we work through our challenges and if we have some bumps initially, we'll solve them. And hopefully in 2015, it'll be a smoother process.
Give us your thoughts on the Medicaid expansion discussion going on at the state capitol. Have you written that off? Do you have any response to the Republican plan that was just put on the table?
Well, I think it's great that we have a plan and that we have a debate going on. Absent a debate, you can't get to a resolution. Expansion is critical because historically, the reason that individuals and small group insurance and large group insurance has been so expensive is that we've had a cost shift that's gone from the uninsured that we've taken care of in the healthcare industry. We've had to raise our rates and continuously deal with the health insurers, and they've had to raise rates in order to cover the uncompensated care. So if you're doing the Affordable Care Act and you're covering those that are over 138% of poverty to 400% with subsidy, and others have a requirement to get out there and get some insurance, if you leave this group in between uncovered that qualify for Medicaid, it's still going to leave a bump in the system and uncompensated care out there and individuals not getting access to care. So it's not really fair to that population. And I think we need to resolve it in the near future.
Well, assuming a Medicaid expansion is not in the cards here in Michigan, what kind of challenge does that pose to Consumers Mutual?
Well, what it's going to do for everybody, actually, is for that group between 100 and 138% of poverty, they will have to qualify for some kind of subsidy. Something will have to be worked out so that they can get insurance through the exchange in some way, shape, or form. Otherwise, we'll have to look for ways to continue to provide some coverage and some mechanism to make that happen for that population. Otherwise, they'll end up in the emergency room without any primary care and their illness is not being taken care of.
Would you prefer to see the latest Republican plan? This involves a 4-year time limit and more responsibilities or more incentives for participants. Would you rather see that than nothing at all?
I think the answer to that would be yes. You need to have skin in the game. And the one thing about the Affordable Care Act and the subsidy program is that individuals have to contribute to their premium, they have to contribute to their out-of-pocket costs, and to the degree to which they are on the lower end of income, they get a little bit more subsidy, in fact, to do that, and on the higher end of income, a little less subsidy. So I think that if you want to design a new Medicaid expansion program to have a little bit more out-of-pocket for the individuals, that will work okay. You know, the I think the argument to that is that, you know, the if that ends up being additional uncompensated care or bad debts that can't be collected by your health care providers, it creates a bit of a challenge. But I think everybody having skin in the game today is the appropriate thing for health care.
Is there a provision, another provision of the Affordable Care Act that particularly concerns you as far as your company's operation goes?
I don't think so. You know, there's certainly going to be, I think over the years to come, some modification to the Act to improve perhaps implementation processes or some aspect of what individuals don't like about it or the problems that evolve as we're trying to operationalize this. But in any major change, there's always going to have to be an evaluation of how it's working, and if it's not working well, what kind of changes do we have to make and implement to make it better?
Stay in touch. We will be keeping an eye on how Consumers Mutual does, and it's been great talking to you today.
Thank you, Mark.
Dennis Litos is the CEO of the new East Lansing-based Consumers Mutual Health Insurance Company. The 50th annual East Lansing Art Festival kicks off this weekend. East Lansing Art Festival coordinator Corinne Van Wyk joins us to discuss this year's event. Hi, Corinne.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. It's the Thursday before the festival. Have you switched to decaf yet? That's my question.
Nope, we can't do that until next week.
What's at the top of your short list? I'm real curious. 2 days out, what's at the top of the short list of the coordinator of the East Lansing Art Festival?
Well, right now we're actually working on site to measure and mark all the spaces for the hundreds of artists that are going to be loading in tomorrow morning. So we're measuring the site, got our maps out there. We're making sure we get everybody positioned properly. So we're working on that today. We'll be at that all day. And just, you know, there's just a lot of fielding questions and making sure all the many, many details are covered.
For people who have attended the event the last couple of years, Corinne, has anything been moved around or will anything be in a you know, noticeably different position than it has been?
Well, actually, the last couple years, we've really been faced with a lot of construction challenges, so we've had to adjust the site here and there. We're actually getting back to a layout that's more typical for this event, where the artists are along MAC, Albert, and Abbott Road. The one difference this year is we do not have any artists located in parking lots. They're all lining the street. I think that'll actually be a nice layout, and it's back to our larger footprint that we had previous to last year. We had a lot of construction last year, so we're still dealing with a little bit of it. What that allows us to do, having the artists on the streets, is the main parking lot that we utilize, which is, I always refer to it as the one behind Beggar's Banquet. People tend to know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
That lot is all programming for the festival, so we've expanded our children's area so that we can offer some things for older people, you know, teens and preteens, and have some more interesting things for them. So we've expanded that quite a lot. The food court is also on the Pinball Pete side of that lot. And the stage where the main music is happening is in the lot that is just north of City Hall. So that's the main layout this year.
You've still got some orange barrels to contend with on Grand River there, though.
Yes, we do. You know, like I said, the construction just has been an ongoing challenge for us. But the one thing that patrons should know is that getting to the festival is very easy thanks to CATA. They're a transportation sponsor, and they've set up a shuttle service that runs all weekend long. People can utilize a lot on campus, which is at Hagedorn and Service Road. There's no fee to park there, and then very nominal to ride the CATA shuttles that are going to be running every 10 to 15 minutes. So people can completely avoid all that construction, hop a shuttle and be right down here and get here without the hassle.
Corinne, quickly walk us through the different offerings of the festival here, aside from just the art vendors.
Well, we have, as I mentioned, we have our children's area, And that really is focusing on arts, hands-on and interactive arts activities for children of all ages. So we've got some major groups that offer wonderful activities for children. So we have Impression 5 is going to be there both days. Reach Art Studio is going to be there. Potter Park Zoo. There's many, many really engaging organizations. Fenner Nature Center is going to be doing nature-based art activities. And then we have performances for families in that area, all manner of things. We have everything from music, traditional music.
Where will we find the music at the festival?
Well, we have actually a few spaces where we're having music. We have sort of our family stage, which is going on in that lot that I mentioned between Beggars and Pinball Pete's. Then we have our main stage, which is all music acts, and that is in the lot at north of City Hall. And then in the little park, we call it the parklet sometimes, that's right on the corner of Abbott and Albert, we will be having informal acoustic music performances all weekend long. So we've got quite a lot of music happening.
How does the art festival benefit the East Lansing community?
Well, you know, it's definitely a tourist draw. I just got off the phone this morning. People from Traverse City, people from Ohio, that they're coming here specifically for this event. And they come here, they stay, they shop and eat. It's really an economic boost to the area. And it really does help the merchants in the downtown quite a lot because the students have now left for the summer, and the summer can be kind of slow. And so this is just jump starts the summer for the local economy. And it also, you know, this is a nationally recognized event. There are several art festivals in Michigan, but there's about 4,000 nationwide, and the East Lansing Art Festival is in the top 100 of one of the best fine art festivals in the nation. So it's definitely well-known, and it just highlights our downtown.
You're at the helm at the 50th anniversary of the East Lansing Art Festival. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, I think that's amazing. I'm actually glad that it's a little older than me, so I can, I haven't caught up to it yet.
You would say something like that.
But, you know, it is amazing. We've been gathering, you know, history and anecdotes from people, just, mementos and memories. And, you know, the art festival is, it really has touched people's lives over the years. It's something that brings them out. It's, you know, the harbinger of spring. It just, you
sure.
know, I've been hearing stories of people, they met their spouse here, you know.
That's great.
And those kinds of things. And it you know, I think having that access to the art and this event, being able to talk to the artist, when you are purchasing a piece of art and you bring that piece of art home, there was really a story behind it, too. And I think that's been going on for 50 years, and there's relationships have been built around this event. And I think it's pretty remarkable.
Current State will be broadcasting live from the East Lansing Art Festival 2 in front of East Lansing City Hall from 11 to 1 on Saturday. Corinne Van Wyk is the East Lansing Art Festival coordinator. It runs Saturday and Sunday. See you Saturday, Corinne. Thank you.
Okay, we're looking forward to it.
Coming up after the break, the best places in Michigan to kayak and canoe with Doc Fletcher. Coming up. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We talked with Corinne Van Wyk, the director of the East Lansing Art Festival, about the economic impact of the art festival. Coincidentally, later today, the Greater Lansing Convention and Visitors Bureau and East Lansing's Anderson Economic Group is releasing the results of a new study. It is entitled Tourism-Related Benefits in Greater Lansing's Economy. One finding we can share with you of how much of that will be, you got to wonder how much of this will be generated this weekend in East Lansing after what Corinne had to say. But according to this report, in 2012, over 4.7 million visitors came to the Greater Lansing area, resulting in over $472 million in total spending at local businesses. We'll get all the rest of the details here later on today. Our next guest describes his ideal afternoon as follows. A few hours in a canoe, probably on Michigan's Pere Marquette River, accompanied by his wife Maggie. She'd be holding a drink, he'd be holding a paddle. Blue herons and bald eagles up above, about 72 degrees, telling stories, and a cold PBR waiting for him afterward at a local watering hole. As you can tell, our next guest knows how to live. Doc Fletcher's been canoeing and kayaking Michigan waterways for many years. He's written 6 books about paddling, not just in Michigan, but other states as well. His most recent released just a month ago is called Michigan's Pere Marquette River, Paddling Through Its History. Welcome to Current State, Doc Fletcher.
Mark, thanks for having me this morning. Now that we have health care out of the way, we can talk about the really important stuff in our state.
Well, this is another way to stay healthy, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
This would lower the blood pressure if you're suffering from hypertension,
I suppose. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's a peacefulness out in the waters that I've not been able to find in any other endeavors in life. It's just a wonderful way to spend an afternoon. It's extremely healthy. Fill your lungs with fresh air. Beautiful wildlife along the way. A very affordable diversion. And I know oftentimes families are trying to find something that's cool for their kids to do with them, and canoeing and kayaking fits the bill very nicely. I should mention one other thing on my perfect day. I would be paddling downstream, and there would be a fisherman along the shoreline. I would ask him how the Tigers did that afternoon. He would tell me they beat the Yankees 8-0, so that would conclude it.
Okay, wow, that's a frosting on the cake there. How did this love affair with paddling unfold, Doc?
Well, interestingly, I never paddled in a canoe till I had graduated from college. It just wasn't something that my mom and dad and family were into. But I can remember in 1977, a group of friends went on the White River over by Muskegon, and they told so many great stories from the adventure. I had missed that trip, and I determined I would never miss another one. So in May of 78, 35 years ago, a buddy had organized a trip on the Pere Marquette. And I went on that river, and I immediately fell in love with it being canoeing in general. I organized a trip 2 weeks later on the Pine River, and 2 weeks after that, we're on the Fox in the UP. And ever since then, during my corporate years, from the mid-70s to mid-aughts, 4 or 5 times a year, I would organize canoe trips and get out on the water.
You've told me the Pere Marquette is your favorite. The latest book is all about the Pere Marquette.
Yes.
For people who've never experienced the Pere Marquette, what makes it so special?
Well, I think it has, among the other things, it has a speed that's slightly above average for most other rivers. There are a lot of steering challenges along the way, deadwood or low-hanging branches that you have to work your way around, beautiful driftwood pieces. On my favorite stretch of the river, which is near the town of Wahala, there's a blue heron nesting area. Absolutely gorgeous. The blue herons tend to build their nest about 50 feet above the waterline, and as you're paddling below, you see the air fill with blue herons and blue herons on the water in front of you. Just gorgeous. It's a nationally designated wild and scenic river, designation well-earned, just absolutely stunningly gorgeous. Very, very nice.
And where is it geographically?
Yeah, it's in the northwest part of the Lower Peninsula. Its headwaters form about 3 miles south of Baldwin. So from Lansing, if you took 96 to M37 on the west side of Grand Rapids, if you went straight north about an hour and a half, you would hit Baldwin. And back up 3 miles to the south, and its headwaters form where two of its small tributaries meet, the Little South and the Middle Branch. And from there, it flows to the west through Branch and Wahala and Custer and Scottville until it finally empties into Lake Michigan right near the Ludington Lighthouse, just south of Ludington.
You're from southeast Michigan, but I know you've spent some time on the rivers here in the Lansing area, like the Red Cedar and the Looking Glass.
Yes.
What do you make of those two?
Oh, those are two wonderful rivers, and the fact that they're right in the backyards of your listeners make them rivers they should go on. They're both major tributaries to the Grand River. The Red Cedar runs for 45 miles. I took a stretch of it that was just east of Okemos, Van Adder Road, at a place called Lake Park.
Yeah,
and for the students on campus who see the Red Cedar rolling through there, the stretch upstream from here has nothing to do with that. It has a very strong Louisiana bayou feel to it. The trees lean in from both shores, and they create a thick canopy over the river. So even on the sunniest day, hardly any rays of light can get through. It has a dark beauty to it. There's trees right in the middle of the river as if they're growing up from the middle of the river floor. There's a lot of deadwood and partial log jams that you have to work your way around. So it's not a particularly beginner-friendly stretch of the river. I took a stretch from Van Anna Road east of Okemos all the way down through the campus area to just before Aurelius Road, shortly before it merges into the Grand River, a 10.6-mile stretch of the river. It's like 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
As you go downstream from that early bayou feel and you're getting closer to campus, you start seeing homes about 50 minutes after launching. You're on the edge of Okemos. There's a great park on the left just before the Okemos Bridge, which is now visible. A fine place to take a break at. And as you go downstream at the 5-mile mark, about halfway between this put-in point east of Okemos and Aurelius Road, there is, where the river's 50 feet wide, a huge logjam midstream, big debris field, about 40 feet wide. There are two narrow 5-foot passages around that debris field. And as the river is narrowed, it picks up speed dramatically. It is a wonderful, wonderful rapids run. Speaking of rapids, the rapids in front of the MSU administration building are some of the most vicious rapids in the entire state. And this is the perfect time of year to hit them. Because if you go later in the year, say June or July, the river has gone down so much that not only are there no rapids, sometimes there's hardly any water at the administration building. But if you go now, it's a wild rapid run. And even before I hit the rapids, I saw them in the distance. I heard the dull roar. I knew it would be a challenge because all the students on the shorelines had stopped walking and flipped out their cell phones and were aiming them at me. Yeah, it was fun.
You were immortal.
Yes.
A lot of our listeners who have canoed or kayaked, I'm sure, have done the Red Cedar. Tell us about the Looking Glass. I've never been on that one.
Yeah, it's a very underused river and one of our nicest in the state. It's quite seasonal. Once you get into late June or July, it can be a little low to canoe. It begins in DeWitt, and it comes to an end in Portland, about 15 minutes west of where we're sitting right now, as it merges into the Grand. In fact, there's a fabulous place to see the merger of these two beautiful rivers, Duke's Canoe Club. A nice bar. They have a deck that overlooks where the Looking Glass runs into the Grand. 30-mile-long river. Its midpoint happens to be at the one livery that services it, Betty Harlow. Harlow's Canoes in the tiny town of Wacoosta. Betty is a trip. She's been running canoes for 44 years. She's as much fun as the river. But downstream from her place, that 15-mile segment to Portland, there's beautiful streams that come in, merge into the river, gorgeous sycamore and birch trees that line the river. There is, at this time of year, there'll be some very nice little whitewater runs also. Gorgeous flowers along the way. It's just a very, very pretty stretch of the river. The Looking Glass, very nice.
We're talking with Michigan canoeer and author Doc Fletcher. River and lake levels are going down. Are you adjusting to that? How noticeable is that to you?
Well, on some rivers, it's incredibly noticeable. There's a river called the Carp, a little north of St. Ignace. We paddled it last year, so in summer of 2012 and in 11. When we went in 11, our group of friends said this is one of the most enjoyable rivers we had ever been on. But after a winter with no snowpack melt to keep the water levels up, by the time we went a year later, we ended up walking the river for about 3 hours just dragging our boats. But many rivers that are spring-fed, such as the Pierre Marquette, my favorite of them all, they're not affected as greatly by the lack of snow. But again, that was last winter. This winter, we should not have that problem. In fact, Betty Harlow on the Looking Glass said the river is as high as it's been in years.
How about that?
So that's very good.
Do you do more kayaking or canoeing? It sounds like canoeing.
Yeah, mostly canoeing, although this afternoon I will be kayaking. We're going to be taking a trip down Crockery Creek, a gorgeous stream between Grand Rapids and Grand Haven. It has the nicest wildlife of any river I have ever been on in the state of Michigan. You paddle through a breeding ground for bald eagles, sandhill cranes, woodpeckers, mallards by the dozens fly by you. Absolutely gorgeous. Again, a tributary to the Grand River. It begins north of the tiny town of Nunica, and then it flows south for 10 miles until it intersects the Grand. So I will be kayaking today, but canoeing I tend to enjoy a bit more. That's how I first was introduced to rivers. And I've noticed over the years that coolers fit into canoes much better than they do into kayaks. So.
Crockery Creek, we will take note of that. What determines which craft you'll use?
I just think it's personal preference. Before I had ever stepped into a kayak, I asked a gentleman who knew rivers very well what was the difference. And he says, well, Doc, when you get into a canoe, it's like driving a semi, and when you get into a kayak, it's like driving a sports car. And he is right. You can turn on a dime in a kayak, you're much closer to the water level, but for longer trips, if there's any camping involved, you need the extra space that a canoe holds. And I, you know, a canoe is my first introduction and my first love, and that will always be my favorite.
Your website is canoeingmichiganrivers.com.
Yes.
Good website. Check it out. Doc Fletcher is a canoer, kayaker, and author of, well, he's working on his sixth book now. His most recently, just released a month ago, Michigan's Pere Marquette River, Paddling Through Its History. Thanks, Doc Fletcher.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
How did these 10 buildings change America? This Frank Lloyd Wright house might have inspired the design for your house. This New York skyscraper just may have been the model for your office building. And copies of this Boston landmark are probably all around you.
I'm Jeffrey Baer. In this show, I'll be crisscrossing the country to visit 10 buildings that changed the way we all live, work, and play.
Houses, skyscrapers.
Back to Civilization, that's WTTW Chicago TV producer and host Jeffrey Baer. He's your guide through the new PBS program, 10 Buildings That Changed America. The show airs Saturday at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. on WKAR World. The show's creators, Jeffrey Baer and Dan Protess, take viewers on a journey across America to examine 10 influential American buildings that changed the way we live, work, and play. WKAR's Peter Wharf sat down with Jeffrey and Dan yesterday. Dan Protess got things started by explaining how the building list was narrowed down to 10.
So we actually didn't do this by ourselves. We had a panel of architects and architectural historians advising us, 16 people from all over the country. And so we asked each of them, you know, if they were doing a show called 10 Buildings That Changed America, which buildings would they focus on? And the 16 advisors all completely disagreed with each other.
Really?
So essentially then we had a list of, I don't know, close to 150 buildings to sort through. And we sorted through them using a number of criteria. First, no more than one building by a given architect, so it didn't become the, you know, the Frank Lloyd Wright show. No more than one building in a given city, so this wasn't a Chicago-centric or New York-centric show. And also, it's important to note that this is an architecture show. So these are not 10 buildings where important things happened. These are 10 buildings that were architecturally significant and that had an impact that influenced the course of American architecture.
What are a few of the buildings that listeners and viewers may be familiar with that didn't make the program?
As Dan described, it was a really difficult process and fun, but painful.
Yeah.
One building that was on our short list almost to the very end was the Air Force Chapel in Colorado Springs, which is a very, very modern building, almost like these tall extended triangles all sort of interlocking with each other. That building was on our short list right up almost till the end. We don't have a California modern house in the show, but we almost did. A house designed by a really important, really seminal architect named Rudolf Schindler, who really was one of the, along with Neutra, was one of the people who sort of established that low-slung, glassy California modern house. And we were going to do his home that was called the Schindler Chase House. That was another one.
We also don't have an iconic New York setback skyscraper, and we certainly could have done the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, but we wanted some unexpected choices in the programs. You know, I think, needless to say, everyone already knows about the Empire State Building. So instead, we focused on the Seagram Building in New York, which is a later glass and steel skyscraper by Mies van der Rohe from the 1950s. But we had considered strongly including the Woolworth Building in its stead.
Looking at the Seagram Building, you talked in the program about the materials, the composition. You mentioned the notion of being set back, the plaza of the Seagram Building. Talk a little bit more about this iconic piece of architecture from the mid-century.
Well, you know, Chicago, where we are, was the home of Mies van der Rohe. Mies was kind of the father of the glass and steel box. And I think as you watch the program, one of the things that comes through is that Today, when we look at these glass skyscrapers of the mid-20th century, some of the very severe kind of austere ones, they're not always beloved. But when you look at the work of the master, of the originator of this style, Mies van der Rohe, there's such a tremendous attention to proportion, to detail. Mies would obsess endlessly about literally the proportion of one window as projected over the entire facade and how the building should be sited on its lot. You know, should it be the narrow end facing the street, the wide end facing the street? Should it be off on a corner of the lot? It was almost like these really austere, minimalist, prismatic kind of sculptures that he was creating, kind of like that slab at the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, that everyone's kind of looking at. So he saw them as these sort of sculptural forms, very minimalist sculptural forms. And, every detail of that was something he obsessed about.
Including the materials, and in the case of the Seagram building, it's bronze. The mm-hmm. entire curtain wall, with the exception of the glass, of course, is bronze. But also, as you point out, the other key to the Seagram building is the huge empty space in front of it, the plaza, which was kind of envisioned as a respite from the hustle and bustle of a city like New York. But unfortunately, as that was copied far and wide and all over the country, instead of these oases in the city, what you ended up having were these huge empty spaces that kind of sucked the life out of a lot of American cities.
Hey, guys, we here in mid-Michigan are a mere 3 hours' drive away from Chicago, so it's a frequent destination for many mid-Michiganders. Can we touch on the Robey House and how that building changed America and influenced so much?
Pointing at each other like, you want to take
you
this
take
one?
This one.
Can you tell we've been doing this for a long time? Its architect called it a source of worldwide architectural inspiration. Humility wasn't Frank Lloyd Wright's strong suit.
You see, early in life I had to choose between honest arrogance and hypocritical humility. I chose honest arrogance.
The Robey House really was a radical... You know, there's a really amazing image at the very, very beginning of the show, so tune in at the very top, because there's a picture of Robey House, and then it kind of goes... whoosh, 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 and kind of morphs into a suburban ranch house.
Yeah.
And you can make a case, and actually one of the architectural historians in our program does, that, the modern low-slung, mid-20th century and beyond ranch house owes a great debt to Frank Lloyd Wright's ideas about these sort of earth-hugging buildings that he called, or that came to be known as the prairie style. Frank Lloyd Wright had taken what was kind of the typical sort of box that was an American house in the Victorian era, and sort of flattened it out, opened it up, created these flowing spaces within the house instead of these little box-like rooms, which was, in his belief, more in line with the way modern people were living. You know, women were becoming more empowered, and they didn't want to be sort of sealed up in little rooms. They wanted to be able to see their family out in the rest of the house and move seamlessly from the house out into the world. That's these homes have ribbons of glass windows. So very influential.
Let's talk about a building from 10 buildings that changed America that is a factory, and it's the closest one to us where we're speaking to you from now. That's the Highland Park Ford plant by Con.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Everyone's heard of Henry Ford, of course, and the moving assembly line. But what not a lot of people know is that the moving assembly line might not have been possible if it were not for the factory building that the assembly line evolved in, the Highland Park Ford factory by Albert Kahn.
When Henry Ford told the architect Albert Kahn that this is what he wanted him to design, Kahn thought he was crazy.
Kahn was not the first one to think that Henry Ford was crazy.
Kahn couldn't imagine why anyone needed so much uninterrupted space under one roof.
But Ford would need it to introduce his moving assembly line.
Remember, Henry Ford was a visionary and a dreamer, and he saw things that no one else saw.
This concrete frame.
Essentially, he uses, you know, before that, factories were basically these big piles of bricks that had tiny windows as you go up toward the top of the factory building, and very confined spaces, which obviously is not ideal if you're looking to create a continuous assembly line. What Kahn does is he builds the factory out of reinforced concrete. This is a kind of reinforced concrete that was actually patented by his brother. And he uses this strong concrete to create these huge open spaces, the kind of open space that Henry Ford needed to build the moving assembly line. But he also is able to create these enormous windows that let plenty of light and fresh air into the factory building, which obviously if you're working with heavy machinery, it helps to be able to see what you're doing and to be able to have fresh air. Of course, the interesting part of the story is that Albert Kahn is Jewish. He's the son of a rabbi. And Henry Ford is a notorious anti-Semite by most accounts. And so we're not quite sure how they were able to work past that, but they were actually able to build 1,000 factory buildings together over the course of their career, starting with the Highland Park Ford factory.
Lansing area people can see something similar with a Motor Wheel building, which is in Lansing on Saginaw Street here in mid-Michigan. Guys, what's next for you? What might be in the works that you could possibly share?
So we've got another local program airing here in Chicago, which I'm sure your listeners will also be able to watch online, called Chicago Time Machine, where we'll be bringing Jeffrey back in time at locations around Chicago. But I'm also in the midst of putting together a proposal for 4 more of these 10 great, we're calling it, for this series. So I'm looking at maybe doing a program about houses, a program about monuments, another about parks, and another about towns. So we're looking to do a few more of these, hopefully.
Well, we'll look forward to more from Jeffrey Baer and Dan Protest, the creators of PBS's 10 Buildings That Changed America, produced by Dan and Jeff from WTTW in Chicago. The program airs again Saturday, 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. on WKAR World. Jeffrey and Dan, thanks again.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you so much.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we catch up with State Rep Andy Shore of Lansing on his gun bill proposals and as much as we have time for that's going on at the state capitol. We discuss the recreation of a rare Stradivarius violin using X-ray technology. Interesting piece. Also, after a successful pilot program, lawmakers are hoping to create a permanent system of mental health courts here in Michigan. Find out more about how they work. All of that will be on Friday here on Current State. Don't forget Current State's live 2-hour broadcast Saturday from the East Lansing Art Festival in front of the East Lansing City Hall. Lots of guests, lots of fun. We'll be looking for you there. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.